Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
The headlines late last week, President Biden gave Iran a one-word warning about attacking Israel. Don't. Over the weekend, Iran did, in a major way. So what should Israel and the U.S. do in response? The deeper dive into the question of retaliation or restraint. Let's start with that. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
In a significant attack over the weekend, over 300 missiles, drones, ballistic missiles fired from inside Iran at Israel. All, of course, were either taken down or deflected off somewhere else. And we want to dive in kind of underneath the headlines in terms of what happens and what happens now. In particular, I thought it was interesting. The president, of course, leading into the weekend was very stern and very specific to Iran. Don't do it. And they did. And now the president is calling for restraint for Israel. And I'm one who believes in restraint, and we have to unpack it in terms of what does that actually mean? And will that serve as a deterrent? Will that further galvanize those against Iran? What does it mean to the region as a whole? So there's a lot to unpack. And before we even begin this course, I want to just caution everyone. We have to walk this stuff through slow. It's so easy to get to the sensational. It's so easy to get just to the headlines. It's so easy to conflate different things, this and that, and who did what, and yeah, but, and all of that. And so we want to take a very methodical approach. We're going to start with just a breakdown of some of the things that we do know. And then we're going to be joined coming up at 1:20 by Robert Sherman from News Nation, who is inside of Israel, who will give us some insight and perspective in terms of what's happening there. So we want to look at all the angles, all the things that are happening, and things to consider. There's just a lot to think through. Of course, this is a region that has had its problems for thousands of years now. And so none of it's going to be solved swiftly, but it should be done strategically. And so let's get some of the things that we do know on the table. Strategic Communication Director for the White House, John Kirby, appeared, I think, on every possible news network over the weekend. He also appeared on CNBC early this morning to talk about the developing situation. Here's how he characterized the conversation between President Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the phone on Saturday after the attack.
The president's message to Prime Minister Netanyahu on Saturday night when they spoke was, first of all, congratulations for an incredible military achievement that Israel and its partners accomplished in defending Israeli sovereignty and the Israeli people, but also to the message that it sends to the world that Israel's not alone and that they are superior and that Iran completely, utterly failed.
So those were important messages coming out of the White House, and just I want to unpack a couple of those, I think, that are important. So one, it was very clear, and in a number of the reports that have come out about the conversation between the president and the prime minister, President Biden was very emphatic to his counterpart, to Prime Minister Netanyahu, saying, take the win. In other words, in his call for restraint, the president was saying, you won. You won the round. You showed Iran, who I think had miscalculated, thinking perhaps that because of what's happening in Gaza and the battle against Hamas, that Israel and the prime minister, for that matter, were very isolated on the world stage. And yes, that has been happening with the escalation in Gaza, the need to get aid in there to innocent civilians. They were becoming increasingly isolated. But it was very clear that they are not that isolated. The fact that the United States and Great Britain and France, as well as Jordan and other Middle East partners, came and were part of shooting down those 300-plus things that were fired into Israel from Iran. And so that's an interesting component, that the president is saying, Mr. Prime Minister, take the win. You won. You showed that Israel is not isolated. You also showed great capability and capacity in terms of defense, and also proved that Iran was ineffective in what they were trying to do. Now, on Meet the Press yesterday, John Kirby was asked if the attack had was going to spark a wider war in the Middle East, and here's how he responded.
The president doesn't believe that it needs to move in that direction whatsoever. Very little got through, and the damage was extraordinarily light. And also, Israel demonstrated again, as I said, that they're not standing alone, that they have friends. The president's been clear, we don't want to see this escalate. We're not looking for a wider war with Iran. Know that the president is working the diplomatic side of this personally. In fact, today, just a little bit later today, he's going to call the G7 together to talk about a diplomatic response.
So looking at how things progress, I think, is the important component to all of this. I thought it was interesting that we had our friend, of course, University of Utah law professor Amos Giora was on KSL News Radio earlier today with Dave and Dejanovic talking about really this lose-lose scenario that Iran had launched and that they had just failed geopolitics 101 in terms of what they launched and what they were actually up against. But I think the interesting thing in all of that is I think the Ayatollah Khomeini was really banking on this idea that the United States was not focused on this, that the supreme leader was really feeling that there wouldn't be a response, that there wouldn't be this kind of rallying around Israel. And so I think in that they definitely miscalculated thinking that they would be able to just do that. There was a lack of resolve. That's sort of been the bet, I think, by Khomeini, is that there's a lack of resolve in the region, especially from the United States. And clearly that's not how things played out over the weekend. Now, I think the test will be what comes next. And so during the White House press briefing today, there was a really interesting exchange between John Kirby and a reporter who asked if America was giving Iran a free pass and free rein to act without consequences. Listen to this exchange.
John, just one day before the attack, President Biden issued a warning to Iran, don't. And now the U.S. is not taking any part in an Israeli reprisal. So does that signal to Iran that it can defy the U.S. without facing any consequences?
I don't know, man. If I'm sitting in Tehran and I'm taking a look at what just happened on Saturday night, I don't think I'd be betting that the United States is not willing to get engaged here and help defend Israel. I mean, you had American fighter pilots in the air, in combat operations, shooting down drones and missiles that were heading towards Israel, as well as U.S. Navy destroyers at sea, knocking them down from there. So the message should be very clear to anybody. When the president says we're going to take our commitments to the region seriously, when we're going to help Israel defend itself, we got skin in the game and we proved that.
Interesting words from John Kirby from the podium just about an hour ago, talking about how things were playing out and what really comes next. It's been very interesting. All of the calls from the international stage have been restraint. And I am one who believes restraint works. There also has to be consequences. And I think this is one of those that's going to get more complicated before it gets more clear. And Israel has remained and retained its right to defend, protect, and be its own deterrent. Sometimes I think the administration, in its desire to de-escalate, has not put strong enough deterrence in place for actors like Iran. Now, we're going to stay with the conversation. When we come back, Robert Sherman from News Nation is going to join us live from Israel. We'll get some response there. And then coming up in hour number two, we're actually going to look at an interesting byproduct of all of this that may actually be a benefit both to Benjamin Netanyahu, the embattled prime minister, and also right here at home with Speaker of the House Mike Johnson. So stay with us. Much more to come on Inside Sources.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. We're staying with the conversation just a little bit longer as it relates to the Middle East and what Israel may do in response to Iran's latest attack. And we're really pleased and grateful once again to have back on the program with us Robert Sherman from News Nation. He is the best of the best. He's dialing in from Israel. And Robert, give us a quick sense of what is the mood, what is the feeling on the ground as you've watched over the last 24 hours?
Yeah, I guess the best way to do that, Boyd, is to compare it to October 8th when I got in here after the October 7th attack. I mean, you know, 6-7 months ago, there was a lot of anxiety and tension on the ground. People didn't know what the next couple of days were going to bring, but they did have a broader understanding that there would be war with Hamas. I mean, there was just so much anxiety here. This go around, it's very different. I mean, you still have anxiety, but I think something to notice is that Israel is a unique country in that the average citizen has an above average understanding of warfare and military capabilities. And why that's significant is that you have a country such as Iran, which Israel is potentially tangling with, which has significantly more firepower than Hamas does. So people recognize that a war with Iran would look very different. So people here are hoping that the situation yields a positive result. Now, that being said, in the wake of that attack on Saturday here, pretty much everybody on the ground is in agreement that from their perspective, that was unacceptable, that was a violation of sovereignty, and there has to be some kind of a response. But war is a game of chess. And if you overplay your hand too much, well, then you have a very different situation. So it's a game of trying to weigh reestablishing deterrence with avoiding sparking the powder keg that is the Middle East right now. That's kind of the sentiment that is on the minds of many people.
Yeah, that restraint versus retaliation and doing that in that chess-like manner, I think, is the real test. And I think it's been so interesting. One, I think Iran clearly underestimated how isolated Israel was, and in particular, the prime minister. And I really wanted to ask you, Robert, what's the sense on the ground? Obviously, Benjamin Netanyahu has been in a pretty tenuous spot of late, even having some of the hostage families joining some of the protesters against the government. Did Iran just give him a chance to maybe be emboldened a little bit, or at least get his sea legs a little bit in terms of what he does next?
I mean, maybe. I mean, here's the deal is that there has been for months, you know, sowed dissent against the prime minister. And a lot of people blame October 7th on him. I think that there needs to be a day of accountability. But there is also, you know, there are some who are calling for early elections, but there are also a lot of people here who believe in the old adage of don't change horses midstream and ride this out and get through the crisis that is at hand and then have the conversation where the country proceeds forward. There really aren't a lot of leaders in Israel right now who have the experience for a situation like this other than Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, you could make an argument for Benny Gantz.
Yeah.
But I mean, aside from that, I mean, it's a pretty short list, all things considered. So it is quite possible. But I'd say that there is that broader sentiment of people do want a sense of accountability, but want to get through the situation that's at hand.
Yeah, no question about that. And as you get a sense for the reaction to the U.S. reaction, obviously the U.S. response in terms of being part of that coalition with the U.K. and France, Jordan, and some of the other allies there in the Middle East in responding there. And then sort of the mixed messages from the Biden administration of the don't to Iran and then restraint to Israel, getting, you know, sending fighter jets, but also condemning it. What is the sense on the ground in Israel in terms of, is the U.S. really there for Israel, or is there some confusion or lack of clarity in terms of, do we really have an ally in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, that is something that people are talking about here, because, I mean, you hear these statements like, we're with Israel shoulder to shoulder, you know, and our resolve and our alliance is ironclad. But then you hear statements that make it conditional, you know. I mean, it is really only on the defensive sphere. If Iran attacks Israel, we're with you. If you attack Iran, we're not going to help you on that front. I mean, that is definitely a factor that goes into this conversation about how exactly is Israel going to respond to this attack on Iran, because I mean, it's possible that they're going to be on their own, you know, when all is said and done here. So, I mean, that's a big part of this here. I mean, I would say that there are so many competing sentiments on the ground. Is that, I mean, there are some here in Israel who believe that some kind of a strike like this, a massive strike, is necessary, but there are others who are worried about what the days after will look like. This all plays into that.
Yeah, give me a sense of, I think you framed that so perfectly, Robert, in terms of those competing sentiments I spent an hour this morning just trying to figure that out myself in terms of, you know, you go headlines and kind of the hyperbole stuff at the top level. But then you've got some real practical, tactical stuff that you've got to get to as well. Anything else that you're sensing over there or anything surprising to you as you've been back on the ground inside of Israel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of context here the average Israeli, you know, I mean, views Iran as this effective puppet master. And there are some people here in Israel who've been saying for years, you know, thump Iran as hard as possible, you know, and this, you know, to an extent, it, you know, provides Israel with a green light in order to satisfy some of those desires. Because, I mean, there is this belief that, I mean, point to a source of tension in the region, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, follow the breadcrumbs back to Tehran. That's what a lot of people look at here. Now, that being said, you know, while there might be that desire from some people on the ground here to be proactive and, you know, carry out preemptive measures against Iran, there are others who think that, you know, I mean, maybe in the long run, that's not the best course of action. Because, again, I mean, you are talking about a much more formidable foe here. I mean, to give you an example, I mean, I'm standing here in Tel Aviv right now. There are people at the beach all day today. You know, I mean, it's like now that the war with Hamas has gotten to this point, you know, I mean, the Iron Dome has been very effective. Hamas's capabilities have been destroyed. People are starting to feel comfortable returning to normal life. War with Iran probably is not going to include days at the beach, is the reality of this situation. It would be a very, very different environment here. It would have significant strains on society, which you're not necessarily sure if, you know, if every citizen wants to bear that cost. Again, it depends who you ask here, but that's all part of this mix.
Yeah. And then final question for you, Robert. I know you are going nonstop over there 24/7. Does this embolden Benjamin Netanyahu, both in terms of obviously dealing with Iran, and I don't think they would be looking at any of the nuclear site targets. I don't think he's emboldened that far. But does it also embolden him in terms of what's going on inside of Gaza? Does this kind of give him a little bit of a reset?
Potentially, because, I mean, we've even seen the defense minister come out today. And, you know, I mean, there are photos of him meeting with his staff talking about what an invasion of Rafah would look like and how to evacuate civilians. I mean, that's as of today. It is so that side of the story has not gone away. I mean, obviously, we're talking about Iran right now. You know, but there's still very much so an active situation going on in Gaza. All signs are pointing to the fact that the Israelis remain committed to go into Rafah, root out Hamas, destroy them once and for all, and then get to the other side of that conflict there. I mean, obviously, you've heard from a lot of world leaders now, including the U.S., who are urging Israel to not do that. But all public sentiment points to that's a matter of when, not if.
Great perspective, as always. Best of the best, Robert Sherman, national correspondent for News Nation, live from Tel Aviv. Robert, thanks so much for making time for us today. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Boyd. Always a pleasure.
All right. That's Robert Sherman, national correspondent for News Nation. He does this as well as anybody in the business. And I always appreciate Robert's perspective because he gives you what you need to know so that you can start thinking and connecting the dots for yourself. And that's what it's all about. We'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. We're going to come back to this topic in hour number two and look at the implications right here in the U.S. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, it is tax day, April 15th, and nothing unites the nation like all of us grumbling that we have to pay our taxes and get our taxes filed. And it is the last day to file your 2023 taxes on time, unless you file an extension, of course. With that comes a lot of conversation about who should pay more and what's going on and what is it getting me and all of that. And so we always turn to someone who helps us unpack all of that. Eric Boehm, of course, reporter at Reason, covers economic policy, trade policy, and elections. And today we want to start with this whole idea of the real tax gap. It is tax day. So who is picking up the tab today? And Eric, welcome back to the show.
Unhappy tax day to you, boys. Thanks for having me.
It's always an unhappy tax day. It does seem to unite the nation, though. It is one of those things that can absolutely unite everyone. I think the two things are everyone having to grumble and file their taxes and anyone standing in a line at the DMV. I think those are the great uniters of the nation at the moment. But give us a sense in terms of a lot of clickbait stuff, a lot of headlines out there. But what's the reality in terms of how tax day plays out and who's actually paying the bill?
Yeah, I'll tell you, my mood was better than usual paying my taxes this year, only because it was such a gorgeous weekend here in Virginia. And I got my taxes done on Saturday and then got to spend the rest of the weekend outside. It actually helped a little bit. But no, frustrated as always. I'm thankful actually for the people who make a lot more money than me who are picking up most of the tab. And that's what we looked at in this piece that's at Reason right now. In fact, I think, you know, this gets lost, I think, in a lot of the rhetoric around taxes, a lot of the talk of, you know, making the wealthy pay their fair share that you hear from the president and many other people on the left and some even on the right at this point, too. The fact of the matter is that close to 50% of all taxes are actually paid by the wealthiest section of Americans. And that share of taxes paid by the wealthy, paid by the top 1% of earners who paid 46% of all income taxes in 2021, that share has actually been increasing over time. The tax code is becoming more and more progressive. I don't think you wouldn't necessarily know that from a lot of the rhetoric that you hear, though.
Yeah, and I think it's so easy to just throw that out there. They should be paying more. And I think it's interesting. You went through and you debunked a lot of these things. And the first one that you mentioned, I just want to have everyone pause on that for a second, that the wealthiest Americans are paying a higher share, a bigger percentage of federal taxes than at any time in the last 40 years. So under Democrats and Republicans, they're now paying more. The wealthiest are paying more than they ever have.
Yeah, that's right. So I think what happens here, I think people get confused about, is the fact that the tax rate on the wealthy has actually fallen quite a bit over the last 50 years. Right, you go back to 1980, and before that, the highest marginal tax rate was 70%, which is just shockingly high. Yeah. I can't believe anyone ever accepted that. These days, it's 37% is the highest tax bracket. So the marginal tax rate on high earners has gone down, but the actual amount of money that they're paying has actually increased over time. And the tax code has become more progressive because fewer and fewer taxpayers at the low end of the scale are paying anything these days, because we've created lots of different tax credit programs, lots of different ways. First of all, of course, the higher allowance under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that lets you take, you know, $12,000 or so just right off the top. You don't owe any taxes on. That's cut out a lot of low income, low and even some mid income people from having to pay taxes at all. So the most recent data we have from 2021 suggests that the bottom 50% of all earners, and that's not all people, that's just people earning money right in the economy, the bottom 50% paid just 2.3% of federal income taxes in 2021. Again, you can contrast that with the fact that the top 1% paid 46% of all federal income taxes. So the rich, you know, I don't know, we can all debate exactly what a fair share actually is. And of course, one of the great things about that talking point is that the answer can always just be more, right? If that's the perspective you want people to take. But the reality is that the wealthy are already shouldering the majority of the tax burden in America.
Yeah. And you noted in your piece, one of the often claims that, you know, that the billionaires are paying, you know, 6% or 8% compared to the person working at the fast food place, you know, paying a higher percentage. And those numbers just don't seem to add up in the end. And so kind of walk us through that quick.
Yeah, sure. That's right. I mean, it's the fact of the matter is that you do have, the amount of money, I think, that somebody who's, you know, looking at the tax rate is not necessarily getting you the ultimate answer there, right, for like how much someone is paying in taxes. So I think that's significant. And I think this disconnect, kind of the bigger point of the piece that I wrote, you know, the tax gap, the idea of a tax gap is the amount, you know, different what the government thinks they're going to collect versus how much they actually do. But there's this kind of rhetorical tax gap that exists, too, because when you do polling on questions like this, what you find is that, you know, 69-70% of Americans support raising taxes on people who are earning over $400,000 annually. That's not even all that wealthy, to be honest. But you do see this appetite out there for raising taxes on the wealthy.
And you also see, I think, just sort of a lack of awareness on the part of Americans about who pays what taxes to begin with. The Tax Foundation actually just put out a great study last week showing that close to 80% of people in this survey that they did, you know, didn't know the share of taxes paid by the wealthiest 1% of Americans. But, you know, at the same time, 65% of people in that survey thought their own taxes were too high. So what you have there is you have a sense, I think, for most people, and this is totally understandable and totally rational even, you know, there's a sense that, well, my taxes are too high, I want to pay less, but I also want to consume government services and someone else should pay for that. So, you know, we make other people pay for it.
Yeah.
But that just lacks an awareness, I think, of just how progressive the tax code is. And that really muddies the water on any sort of conversation about how the tax code should change.
Yeah, no question about that. And I do just want to go back to that point. I'd love to see a poll question to ask. Do you think it would be right for the government to tax 70% of anyone's income? To just take 70% of whatever you're earning, we're going to take 70 cents on the dollar. I don't know that anybody would sign up for that one. But let's get to the kind of one final thing before I let you go real quick. I think part of this also comes to the fact that you were alluding to that on one hand, we want to consume more of those government services. And at the same time, we're less and less satisfied with what we're receiving from government. How does that play into all of our attitudes and perceptions about taxes?
Yeah, well, certainly the lack of understanding about the way the tax code works and the lack of understanding about who pays the bulk of federal taxes, as I said, it muddies the water on some of these conversations about what changes should be made. And we have to have those conversations, Boyd, as you know. I mean, we talk about this on this program all the time. The United States is running a massive annual deficit, like structural deficits, right? To get that under control, to get the debt under control, to address Social Security, all of these conversations will require some sort of trade-off of, you know, well, do we cut things the government spends money on? Do we raise taxes? If we raise taxes, who do we raise taxes on? And it's difficult, I think, for Americans to grasp those, you know, the answers that they may have, the sincere answers that they may have to those questions, because there is this lack of understanding about who's already paying for it. And obviously that's stoked by people in our political system. You know, when the president's out there saying millionaires and billionaires have to pay more, millionaires and billionaires are paying less than the worker at a fast food restaurant. You know, that's just fundamentally not true. It's not an accurate picture of the way the tax code works. But if you think that way, and polls suggest many voters do, then it certainly it makes it seem like these problems are more easily solved than they actually are. Hey, just raise taxes on the wealthy, that'll fix it.
Yeah.
When in reality, that's not the case.
And yeah, and will never be the answer. And whether it's the populace on the left or the populace on the right, it never comes up and it never adds up in the end in terms of what we need to get to. Eric Boehm, reporter at Reason, best of the best in breaking it all down for us. And just so you know, it is a dreary, cold tax day here in the state of Utah, not just because I have to get mine done.
It should be miserable.
All right. Fantastic. As always, Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Boyd.
All right. That's Eric Boehm from Reason. And it's important. The bumper sticker stuff, the campaign slogan stuff is easy when it comes to taxes. Actually collecting the taxes, who pays them, what we get out of that, that's the discussion we've got to get to. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Mathison on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It is great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Mathison. And, you know, last Friday I wasn't here in the studio because I was at a place that actually made my day. I was part of the 2024 Kindness Summit. It was held up at the University of Utah, and it was just an amazing day with some extraordinary people. We always round out this program by talking about what we can do to make a difference. And One Kind Act is an organization that is determined to do just that. It's an amazing initiative. Of course, Khosrow Simnani and the Simnani Family Foundation were the driving forces in launching this and moving it forward. And we wanted to do just a little breakdown. We're going to have some of the extraordinary stories that took place and were shared at the summit last Friday as we go through the week this week. But really pleased to have back on the program with us Curtis Bennett, who's the executive director at One Kind Act today. And Curtis, I hope you've recovered from a very big summit over the weekend.
I have indeed. It took about 6 extra hours of sleep on Saturday, but I got it done.
Fantastic. Well, for our listeners, give us a little bit of the backstory in terms of One Kind Act, and give us your perspective on how the day played out.
The day couldn't have gone better, in my personal opinion. A lot of it had to do with just so many people who came in support for what One Kind Act Today is all about. And as you stated, One Kind Act Today is thanks to Khosrow Semnani and the Semnani Family Foundation. And the impetus behind this was we need to change the narrative. We can do better. We can deal with one another in a kinder, more gentler way. And so Mr. Semnani began this foundation, funded it so that it doesn't need any further resources. It's got all the resources that it needs. And we can do events like the one that we did the other day. And I will say that we had just a stellar MC who did a really great job. And we're so grateful that he was there to help us promote this message and advocate this cause.
It was a privilege and an honor to be there with such an extraordinary group. And I just want to dive into some of the conversations that were had. And one of those talked about this whole idea that if each of us help two of us, there's enough of us to deal with anything. We can solve all kinds of problems. If each of us will help two of us, there is enough of us.
So that was a statement that was made by Darren Margolius, as you know, who's the executive director of Beast Philanthropy. And what an amazing individual. And he's a guy who should know, because, as you know, the reach of their influence is significant, with nearly 500 million subscribers to their YouTube channel promoting goodness, kindness, charity, positivity. And so, I mean, if anyone can and should make that statement, it would be him. But what a great statement.
Yeah, it was really amazing. And you just started seeing the ripple effect. That was such an inspiring thing to me. We also had the opportunity to have an interfaith conversation that was just, I don't even have words for it. It was just an extraordinary thing with an incredible panel. Give us your perspective as you watch that play out.
Well, once again, I have to give kudos to the moderator. That was you. And so thank you very much again. But, you know, we had an idea that was probably going to be one of the more impactful moments of the day, to be able to bring in someone. You know, we had an imam there. We had Rabbi Spector. We had Bishop Spiegel. We had Bishop John Western. Rabbi, it was Imam Dawood Yassin. And then Elder Brian Taylor. We had this beautiful cross-section of all of these different religious cultures and beliefs. And you know as well as I do, the message was powerful, but the imagery of all of those magnificent individuals standing on stage, linking arms one with another was what we were really hoping for. That image is ingrained in my mind and in my heart. I'll never forget that day.
Yeah, it was a truly powerful moment to see all of those leaders on stage, linked and locked arms, really looking at this is how we make a difference in the world. And we all have a role to play. No small parts or players in this thing. Everybody has to play big. And when we do that, we really can change the trajectory of things. Give us a sense of the trajectory. What comes next for One Kind Act?
You know, I have to tell you, Boyd, and I am so grateful and I'm humbled by it. If you were able to look at my email and my text messaging and my other social media feeds right now, I'm not quite sure how we're going to keep up. whether we wanted to or not, whether we devised it this way or not, we've gone to a new level. And the new level is inspiring. And it's inspiring because it's because of people who are literally reacting and acting on the impressions and the thoughts and the intents that they had throughout the course of the day. And they're saying, there is something we can do, and I do want to be involved. And so, by golly, I will be. And so, like I said, I'm inundated right now with all of these people who are saying, let me know what more. What can we do?
I love it. And this is the big bite and the long chew, as we like to call it on this show. Long chew has begun. Also, give us a sense. This was another thing that was just so exciting to watch play out, and that is that you haven't been content to have this just be kind of a high-level thing. I love the fact that there were high school students in the audience, and I love the fact that you're spending and giving so much attention to getting schools, young grade schools, involved in becoming part of this movement of One Kind Act.
So thank you so much for bringing that up. We really felt it was important that we had to bring this younger generation in. And we had high school age kids there, and we had college age kids there, because we feel that this narrative is something that we need everyone to hear. And the sooner we can get them to hear it, the better off we are. And I have to say, and I don't know if this is an announcement or anything, but the recommendation has been from a number of sources, we should do exactly what we did, but with a bunch of youth. We should bring youth in from all over and do the exact same thing that we did with these adults.
Absolutely. All in, I think, is the answer to to that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that is fantastic. Curtis Bennett is the executive director at One Kind Act a Day. It was the 2024 summit on Friday of last week. We're going to have a number of these organizations that are out there doing everything from helping those on our street who are in need of a good meal, to those who just need a good smile, to those who need support in other ways, and people not waiting for government to do something, not waiting for a mandate to do something, not waiting for a catastrophe to do something, but just doing One Kind Act. We can all do that every day. Just imagine what would happen, the flood, the momentum that would take place if everyone was just committed to just One Kind Act today. Curtis Bennett, again, executive director of One Kind Act. Thanks so much for joining us. And a big thanks to Khosrow Semnani and the Semnani Family Foundation for making all this possible.
Our privilege, and thank you.
All right. Such an important thing. And again, on days like today, when it's easy to get a little down, a little dreary, a little pessimistic about what's going on in the world, what's happening in our politics, all you have to do, if you want to have a little hope for a better day, for a brighter day, is to just do One Kind Act. It's not a big thing, but I'm telling you, it is the biggest of things, and it is the best of things. It'll change your world, might change somebody else's in the process. And we're going to continue this conversation as we go throughout the week this week and touch base with some of these organizations right here in our community who are making a difference. That's the name of the game, gang, and that's how we can have great confidence in what lies ahead for our community and for the country. That wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll step aside for some top of the hour news. Don't go anywhere. Big hour number two coming up next. Stick around.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We're continuing to focus on some of the things that really matter in terms of where we can make a difference and what individuals can do when we just decide to do that. And I think it's important, and we should never forget that real change always starts at home. Without the first small step into your community toward your neighbor, the big goals we're all reaching for will never happen. And so we're going to get to an important space today as we begin hour number two. We're going to step into the space in between. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, this is one of the stories over the past year that has stirred me like no other. And it's time to come back to that conversation. We started with a conversation several months ago with Lois Collins from the Deseret News, who did just a brilliant deep dive into this organization called The In Between. And we're really thrilled to have joining us on the program today, Jillian Olmsted, who's the executive director of The In Between. And Jillian, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Boyd.
So for our listeners who aren't familiar, describe, I think it's holy ground myself, but describe this space, In Between.
Sure. So we're providing a home-like environment for individuals who are experiencing homelessness and a medical crisis. So we were originally created to fill that gap in services for someone who's too well to stay in the hospital but too sick to be on the streets or in the shelter. So think about how, if you've had anyone experience hospice services, they have a home and family to help provide that care, and homeless individuals don't have that. So we're providing that space for individuals to receive professional hospice care, or if they're not end of life and they just need some recuperative care, they can stay with us to qualify for life-saving cancer treatments or a variety of different medical treatments that might help someone get better versus continue to decline out on the streets.
Yeah, and I think that's one we often don't think about. Often when we talk about the unhoused and those that are experiencing homelessness, we don't think about those who might actually be in need of hospice care or end-of-life care. And we often don't think about that, and I think this is such a beautiful way to go about providing that. Tell us how you got to this. How did this begin? What was the kind of the genesis story of this?
Yeah, so it was actually a nurse up at Huntsman Cancer Institute that was finding it very difficult to discharge these cancer patients or people who qualified for hospice care back to the streets. And so she spent many years trying to get this idea off the ground, worked with an interfaith roundtable in the local area with a lot of religious leaders, and then also worked closely with 4th Street Clinic. Eventually, they created a board of directors and a 501c3, and they opened in a small convent and elementary school close to downtown. And they were initially just taking in individuals who were hospice, and we quickly realized that we needed to have that medical respite side as well, in hopes that we can get to people before their end of life and give them a chance to get better instead of just waiting for them to get worse. And then in 2018, we found this newer, bigger facility, which is much more ADA compliant. It's not two stories. They're just shared rooms of two people, or our hospice patients have a private space. And it's definitely evolved over the years, and we're now assisted living type 2 facility. So we have licensed beds through the state, and then also congregate care. Which is really the difference between those two, is just what level of care do people need? Do they need medication management and assistance with toileting, eating, transferring from their bed to their wheelchair, things like that? But yeah, it was just a great need for people. Where do they go when they discharge if they're not well enough to take care of themselves?
Yeah, and I think as we look at how we do that, I think how we treat those that are struggling in those circumstances speaks volumes about where we are as a society. And one of the things that I wanted to highlight on those that are kind of in those last stages, you have a philosophy there that I think is important for us to think about in terms of this whole idea of no one dies alone. Describe that for us.
Yeah, so, you know, we believe everyone deserves dignity at end of life, no matter what choices they made. And since these individuals don't often have friends or family, and we have limited staff, we want to make sure that when they're close to passing, that they have someone next to their side. So we created this program at the in-between that adopted the No One Dies Alone program, which is a nationally recognized volunteer program. We train our volunteers. We actually just had a training this Saturday. It's about 3 hours long. Our nurse attends, our end-of-life doula attends, and our community engagement manager attends as well. And we just explain exactly what it's going to be like sitting bedside with someone, what to expect, when to call the nurse to have them come in and help. And so when someone's actively passing, we send an alert to all of these trained NOTA volunteers, and they can sign up for shifts 2, 4, 6 hours long, and they can come and sit. And our end-of-life doula has already met with this individual and already knows what their wishes are end of life. Do they want a chaplain to come in? Do they want music playing? Do they want someone to read to them? Or do they just want it to be kept quiet and calm? And so the volunteers and our end of life doula make sure that that happens for our residents.
Yeah, that's such a powerful thing. Give us something that you've taken away from this experience. There's always those things when you start out on a journey like this, or as you're working in this kind of environment, you have kind of those aha or wow moments. Share one of those with us.
I think it's that everybody is capable of change, no matter what they've been through in their life. We've been talking a lot about a resident who recently moved out. She came to us years ago, and she was given 6 months to live. And most of the homeless resource centers in the city had banned her or given up on her because she was quite the client. And she came back to us, and she was willing to accept the help, and she was willing to make some changes. And You would never know this of her talking to her now. She's the sweetest woman, and she's cancer-free. She's living in her own apartment, paying her own rent, and she's doing really well. She's stopped by to see us a couple of times, and I think if you were to have asked me when she first came in if this was possible, I probably would have said no. So I think it's just the amount of change that people can experience here when they see something different for themselves. And I think sometimes being caught up in the shelter system and substance use or mental health, they don't see anything better for them than what they're currently experiencing. So we try to give them a, you know, just a look of what it might be like to get their own space again if they if they get better. So we do work with people if they are going to recuperate. We're case managing them to get them onto housing lists, get them on any benefits that they qualify for, and we try to break that cycle of homelessness if at all possible during their stay with us.
Fantastic. This is just extraordinary stuff. Jillian Olmsted is the executive director of the In Between, I-N-N, Between, the In Between. This is an extraordinary group making a difference in the lives of individuals in our community. You can be part of that as well. Jillian, thanks for all you're doing, and thanks for joining us on Inside Sources today.
Thank you, Boyd.
That's Jillian Olmsted, executive director of the In Between. That'll get you to think again about what you think you know about end of life for someone who may be living on the street. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
We're coming back to the Middle East discussion to understand how this is all going to impact a lot of the battles going on in our nation's capital. And as I was trying to make sense of all of this and try to get past the headlines, connect the dots, this morning I turned to a place I always turn first thing in the morning. It's the Early 202 newsletter from the Washington Post. And, of course, Theo Meyer is a national political reporter and co-author of the Early 202. It's where I often start my morning. It's where you should start your morning. And some great insight in terms of how what has taken place over the weekend with Iran firing all that weaponry into Israel. And, of course, the alliance coming together to knock all those down or get them off course. And now we're to the now what? What comes next in the conversation? And really pleased to have Theo back on the show. And give us your sense in terms of what this looks like in our nation's capital. As we return, we've got Speaker Mike Johnson, who's got all kinds of challenges inside of his conference and across the planet. Now he's got some new dynamics in there, not just with Ukraine, but now Israel.
Glad to be with you. Yes, you're right. I think this amps up the pressure on Johnson a little bit. We were already expecting Johnson to move forward with some sort of Ukraine aid package this week. What exact form that would take remains unclear. But I think on the Israel side, you know, this attack has, you know, heightened the desire by at least some Republicans in the House to move forward with an Israel aid package sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and so as you look at that, and you noted this in the 202 this morning, that there was a call with President Biden, Speaker Johnson, Majority Leader Schumer, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, all kind of navigating their way through that. And kind of walk us through, some are just saying, hey, pick up the Senate's $95 billion with Ukraine, Israel, Gaza humanitarian, and Taiwan. Some are saying standalone Israel. I see the White House is now starting to say, no, don't go there. What's your sense with kind of the competing angles and ways that this might be brought to the floor of the House?
Well, Democrats and Republicans have been battling over this for months, all the way back. For 6 months, you know, since October, when President Biden first requested this aid package that included money for Ukraine, money for Israel, some money for Taiwan as well, and humanitarian relief for Gaza. The Senate, as you might remember, battled for months over this. They tried to attach border security measures to it that ultimately failed, and the Senate passed a bill that looked like what Biden had originally requested. So now the House has to decide, do they just pass the Senate bill which a lot of Republicans are very against because they do not want to aid Ukraine. And also perhaps because the House is often loath to just pick up what the Senate has passed and pass it themselves.
Right.
Or do they, you know, try to create their own version of the legislation? Or do they do nothing or just try to move an Israel bill on its own?
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. And you're so right. The House just doesn't like to pick up things that were done in the Senate and pass them. That doesn't seem to be the way they have ever responded under whether it's Republicans or Democrats in charge. But as you look at that and as you look at the dynamics and what Speaker Mike Johnson is facing, does this give him an interesting lane to navigate? Because clearly there was a letter this morning from 75 or 100 members of the House, Democrats and Republicans, saying, hey, pick up the Senate bill and go. Does this give him a space to say, look, there's enough international conflict. We just need to get this done, knowing that or hoping, I guess, that the Democrats would pick up anything by Marjorie Taylor Greene in terms of vacating the chair?
Well, so support for the Senate bill or, you know, something relatively like the Senate bill probably has the support of almost all Democrats, except for, you know, maybe two dozen or so, maybe fewer, who are so concerned about Israel aid that they would vote against such a bill rather than sending more military aid to Israel. And probably roughly half of House Republicans remain supportive of an approach like that. So that is probably enough to pass something under suspension, which requires two-thirds of lawmakers to pass. But there's all sorts of things that you don't have to do. You don't have to pass a rule, and you get around a bunch of procedural stuff that way.
Okay.
So that is one route that Johnson could go. But it would make the other half of House Republicans really mad at him.
Right. Which I think is going to be his job for as long as he's in that job, is the deciding and picking who he wants to be mad at him at any given moment. I think that's part of the gig these days, it seems like. All right, Theo Meyer, national political reporter for The Washington Post, co-author of the Early 202 newsletter. Theo, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
All right, and that's Theo Meyer, national political reporter for The Washington Post. And I think it's interesting as we watch all of this play out, there are so many unique dynamics coming into this, and I actually think it could be an interesting opportunity for Speaker of the House Mike Johnson to act and to have some confidence that he can act. To get this aid package done that would benefit Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and some humanitarian relief into Gaza. And that I think he would have enough Democrats that would back him if Marjorie Taylor Greene decided to pull the trigger on vacating the chair, in other words, creating a new speaker battle. I think it actually could serve the Speaker of the House well to engage there. Now, really interesting, things are changing so fast. So the White House has come out and said to the House, do not send us an Israel-only aid package. So that's coming from the White House. Meanwhile, the Freedom Caucus has also put out a statement saying that they do not want this to be an excuse, that what has taken place in Israel to be an excuse for passing Ukraine funding without real debate. And so I think that, again, interesting coming from the different flanks of the different parties to see what they're willing to do, what they're not willing to do, where they want to stand their ground, where they want to make a political point. And hopefully in all of that, we have enough people who get to the principle and policy question of what is in the best interest of the United States and what is in the best interest of our allies, in particular Ukraine and Israel. And what does that mean in those areas? What does it mean as it relates to Vladimir Putin and to China and to North Korea? Because they're all interconnected with Iran. So there's a lot of messages that are being sent, and not just those that are on the headlines today. It's a lot of the underneath stuff where the real conversations are going, where the real diplomatic dances are being had. And so we're going to watch this very closely as we see what Speaker of the House Mike Johnson decides to do. I think this will be a definitive moment in his time in the Speaker's chair with the Speaker's gavel. how he, not only what he does, but how he does it, I think is going to have a big impact. And this is a moment where he may lead, and he may lead in a way that surprises people in terms of how he goes about his work. And I think he is one. We had him on the program last week, and he is one who I think makes the decision, and he doesn't have his finger in the wind, and he's not just going to poll test something. And he is someone who deeply appreciates the institution of Congress and recognizes the need for us to rebuild some trust and confidence in Congress. And this may be one of those moments. So we're going to watch this very close. And, of course, KSL News Radio's got you covered as everything continues to transpire in the Middle East, as well as continues to unfold in Ukraine and other parts around the world. And all of this, of course, impacts us right back here at home. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Don't go anywhere. More Inside Sources coming up next. Stick around.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, wherever you are listening, just settle in, sit down. You're going to think again about what you think you know. And this is a fascinating conversation based on an extraordinary piece in The Atlantic. It's called The Consequences of the Serengeti Land Grab. So in the name of conservation, the African government has snatched hundreds of acres of land away from its indigenous people, the Maasai. The question then becomes, is boosted tourism worth the death of a culture? Does the government have the right to do this? Who are the stakeholders, and whose land is it anyway? And this is just an extraordinary piece. Really thrilled to have joining us on the program for the first time, Stephanie McCrumman, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's won numerous awards for her political journalism, two George Polk Awards and a Pulitzer Prize. Not a bad resume, but she's a great writer, and this is a piece you should just go absorb. It's the only way I can describe it. You don't just read it. You have to experience it. And Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for that nice introduction.
So give us, for our listeners who didn't wake up this morning thinking about the Serengeti and the Maasai, give us a perspective of what led you to this, and give us the real essence of the issue.
Sure. My previous one of my previous jobs was to be a foreign correspondent in East Africa. So I had written about issues similar to this in the past and heard of what was happening in Tanzania. So the story is about what's unfolding in northern Tanzania with regard to the Maasai. And the Maasai are a pastoralist people. They're cattle people. So their culture, their way of life, their livelihood revolves around keeping cattle. And they migrated into northern Tanzania approximately 400 years ago. And they settled in this extraordinarily lush land that they called Serengeti, which in the Ma language means the place where the land runs on forever, and is now, of course, more familiarly known as Serengeti. And so they settled in this area, and then really ever since the colonial period in the 1940s, 50s, in this time zone, their history really has been a history of trying to hang on to this land. So the British colonial authorities were sort of the first ones to evict the Maasai. They evicted the Maasai out of, what is now Serengeti National Park. And so the Maasai people live currently, there are about 200,000 people who live in and around this tourist zone. And perhaps some of your listeners may have been lucky enough to go on a safari, and they would know the Maasai people as people who wear bright red shawls and lots of beads, and they often serve as guides on safaris in this part of Tanzania and Kenya, I should say, as well. But the Maasai have really come into conflict with the safari industry, with conservation groups and successive Tanzanian governments in recent decades.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so interesting, and you tell the story in such a rich way in terms of how they're trying to hold on to that and what that looks like, and the fact that they're being told by these groups that you just named, between the governments, the conservation groups, the safari groups, that they're the problem in all of this. And I just have to read this. I'm going to quote you to yourself.
Sure.
Because it's so good. And I want our listeners to get this, that the reality is that the Maasai have been stewards, integral in creating the very ecosystem. And you also point out that the same can be said of a lot of indigenous groups around the world who are natural conservationists.
Yeah, so I'm so happy that that you're keying in on this point, because yes, so the image that gets sold very often of the Serengeti ecosystem and many parts of the world, including, I should say, places like the Yosemite Valley in the United States, but the image that gets sold is in a way that this is a primordial landscape, that this is somehow a pre-human landscape that has, sort of untouched, so that when you see it, you're just looking at, unbridled, nature before humans came. The reality is closer to, Serengeti is more like a tended landscape. The Maasai lived there for 400 years. And of course, they're being cattle people, they need grasses. So their culture really revolves around maintaining this ecosystem. They have very intricate land management systems traditionally. So they do controlled burns, they rotate grasses. They have rules around not cutting down trees and moving their cattle during, when the wildebeest are in their calving season. They will move away because they know the wildebeest carry a certain disease. It's deadly to cattle. So during that time. And so, so the true, when we see the Serengeti on a documentary film or these breathtaking photos, we're really looking at a landscape that the Maasai had a very serious hand in creating. The grasses that their cattle need are also the grasses that zebras need, antelope, these other wild animals. And so this is, as you said, yes, this is true of many indigenous groups around the world.
Yeah, and I just think that's something we always have to come back to, that the people who are closest to the land are usually the best stewards of the land, because they get it. And too often we make it complicated and have some government or some agency say, no, we know better.
Right. And so really from, if you're an indigenous person, and the Maasai consider themselves to be an indigenous people, and you hear that, this land is going to be walled off in the name of conservation, you think, well, what does that mean? We were conserving it. So they hear this word, they often consider it to be synonymous with land grab, some kind of a land grab, or something that in any case is going to cause them trouble. And that is indeed, what is happening in northern Tanzania, that many thousands of square miles of land are being set aside in the name of conservation, which turns out to mean tourism, which turns out to mean a hunting playground for the Dubai royal family, for example, in one case that I wrote about.
Yeah, that is so fascinating. This is such a rich read. We could spend like 2 hours going through just the stories that you're painting there. Give us one thing as you've gone through this whole process. Kind of give us what's your therefore what out of this in terms of where things are and what you hope to see as this battle and this tension continues.
Well, I should say, I can rather channel, what Maasai leaders would hope to see, or maybe is more appropriate. And the Maasai are not against tourism at all, or tourists. And I hope that the story did not intend to sort of vilify tourists at all, who were, after all, anyone would be lucky to see this, this incredible landscape and animals in this place. And meet the Maasai as well. So the Maasai would hope to be part of the solution in northern Tanzania. They want to be consulted. They want to be, you know, have their rights respected. And they, you know, they would like to, you know, to see tourism flourish. And they would also like to see their culture flourish as well. And you know, they think that that is very much possible. And that what is happening right now in northern Tanzania is really, it really just doesn't have to be that way, that it's unnecessary.
And I think that it's such a great example of getting lost in all of the complexities of it all and redefining of, I mean, everyone hears conservation and everyone cheers, and we should. That's an important thing.
Sure.
But when we redefine it, and it's like you said, it's safari and it's this, that, and the other, it sort of loses that context, which usually leads us to really bad spaces. Again, this is so rich. You need to just go sit down and read this today. It'll change your perspective, and it will give you perspective. Maybe in some ways that will surprise you. Stephanie McCrumman, staff writer at The Atlantic. You can check it out at theatlantic.com. And this is the part of their magazine coming up for May as well. And Stephanie, we really appreciate you joining us, and fabulous writing, beautiful perspective. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. We'll step aside for one last break. It's a brilliant piece. It will literally, the writing will transport you to the Serengeti. And you'll see the lives of the Maasai, what they're doing, what they're up against, and what conservation really means in the end. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program today, if you've missed anything along the way, you missed a lot today. We spent some good time really diving into the issues underneath the headlines as it relates to Iran, Israel, Hamas in Gaza, Ukraine, Russia, and a host of other things that come to the international front and what actually comes next. We're watching very closely to see what Speaker of the House Mike Johnson will do as it relates to aid for Israel, whether he tries to do that as a standalone package, whether he takes up the Senate-passed bill. Again, already cleared the Senate that has $96 billion of aid for Israel, Ukraine, for Taiwan, and also humanitarian aid for Gaza. Whether that becomes the path on a bipartisan basis and what that means for the speaker and for keeping the gavel as speaker. We'll continue to watch all of that as it continues to play out. And most importantly, we'll continue to watch the unrest in the region and see what Israel chooses to do next. President Biden has sent a clear message, although clarity may not be the right word, as he gave Iran, very clear mandate, don't do it before the weekend. They did it. Now he's telling Israel not to respond or to retaliate, to show restraint. That becomes part of it. The president saying, take the win. You were able to defeat the 300-plus missiles and drones that were sent towards Israel. So that's going to continue to be a dominant force as we go through the week this week. And so we'll continue to cover all of that here on KSL News Radio. And I also want to just take a quick peek in terms of what comes next on all of that, because you do have the White House saying don't do a standalone Israel package. You've got the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives saying don't do the big package with aid for Israel and Ukraine tied together. They want to see that separately. So we'll watch all of that. And then, of course, the real unifying force in the United States of America today is the grumbling we all have as we file our taxes. And it is a little bit of a dreary day here in the Beehive State, maybe appropriate for those of us getting the taxes in at the last minute. You do have till midnight to get those in or file an extension, of course. Check with your provider on that one. But an interesting conversation we had earlier in the day with Eric Boehm from Reason, and just busting some of the myths around taxes in this country, because taxes have become the political playground and great bumper sticker slogans and a great way to rally the base or great one-liners in speeches for both Democrats and Republicans. And I thought it was interesting that Eric Boehm kind of went and blasted through a lot of the rhetoric, the very populist rhetoric from both the left and the right. And of course, the most common is, you know, get the rich to pay their fair share. Well, what is that? And what does that actually mean? The wealthiest Americans are now paying a higher share of federal taxes than at any time in the past 40 years. And yet there's still this gap between what the American people perceive in terms of the tax code and who is actually shouldering the burden of most of the costs. And so it's not, it's again, it's easy for populists. It's easy to do the class warfare thing. It all works out really well. The president has used a phrase for many years now that just simply doesn't add up. And that is that American billionaires pay an average of just 8%. That's been debunked and by multiple people on both the left and the right who just say, stop saying that because it's not true. The more important thing is that we have to start to understand where we are in terms of what's being collected. And yes, the wealthy are paying the bulk, the lion's share. Now, have tax rates gone down for the wealthy? Yes, they have over the last few years, which is interesting. And most people don't recall that in 1980, the highest marginal tax rate was 70%. Now, even if you're making a whole lot of money, there's something that doesn't feel very fair share if someone is taking 70 cents out of every dollar that you earn. That's a pretty high cost. And so now we've settled into about 37% as the highest marginal tax rate. But again, it's easy to vilify and demonize and do the class warfare thing. The reality is I think less about how much more taxes we need to collect. I think we've got to figure out how much we're spending because that's where the bigger hole is in the boat. It's about what we're spending and quite honestly, what we're spending it on. And so to me, we've got to get past just a tax question. We can have a tax question. That's fair game. And we should decide that in front of the American people, not behind some closed doors in some 2000 page bill. Nobody's going to read. So let's talk about it. Who should pay what? Let's have that. Fair and square, straight up, make it straight. And then let's talk about what are we actually spending that on? And most important, what are we getting out of it? If the American people are going to pay taxes for government services, they better get really, really good government services. And they better be able to hold their elected officials accountable for what services they're getting, what services they're not getting, the quality, and most important, the results, because it always comes down to the results in the end. All right, that wraps it up for us on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. I am Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us today. And as always, as you go out into the world, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.